The Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. It takes a certain kind of brave to run a business. We see it, we back it.
Now, many of us have been experiencing homeschooling this year, more than we would like possibly for all generations. Our next guest has developed voice tech for children to help with reading skills. The technology is licensed to other companies to use for toys, robots and games. The company recently raised over €6 million in Series A funding. Patricia Scanlon of Soapbox Labs, you're providing software that enables a child's speech to be recognised by a computer. So, in a way, you're taking on the Googles and the Siris of this world. But am I right in saying that the point of difference for you is that it's aimed at the children's market?
Yeah, very much so. So, you know, children's voices are very different to adults. If you think about it, they're smaller, right? So they're physically very different. They've got thinner, shorter vocal tracts, smaller vocal folds. Their behaviours are vastly different. And their language is really different as well, right? So, like, you know, kids won't follow the language structures of adults, particularly when they're young. You know, a four-year-old speak very different to an eight-year-old. You know, they'll sing, they'll whisper, they'll over-enunciate,
They'll shout, they'll sing.
And all those differences combined really mess with a system that's been built modelling adult voices and adult behaviours. So the Googles and the Apple Siris and the Alexas will all work to a certain extent, but they'll work maybe 60, 70% of the time. So often we have people testing all those systems in the world and then they come to us because they want a system that works accurately and robustly for children.
And it's funny because when you mention it and I think about it, people, adults, tend to put on a certain voice, don't they, when they address Alexa or Siri. It's sort of like they put on their best calm voice. A child isn't necessarily going to do that.
Totally, right? So what I do, and I think most of your listeners will know this too, is that you kind of straighten yourself up and you think about what you want to say and what you want to get out of the interaction with Alexa or Siri or whatever. And you kind of like phrase it in a way that you know you'll get the best response. And it's learned behaviour over the last couple of years of using these things. Kids just don't comply. They just blurt out.
I suppose it has to be more flexible. And one of the things that is a challenge with all of this technology is accents. Do you have to keep updating it, or where are most of the end customers from?
Yeah, I mean, completely. Do you know what? Today's world just is international, right? So, I mean, so when we looked at this in the beginning, we thought about a school in New York City or in Dublin, and you're not going to get only Dublin accents or only New York accents, right? You're going to get accents from Britain, from India, from southern US states. We've collected English-speaking children's accented speech from over 170 countries.
Are you confident Patricia could tackle any Irish accent, could it?
Yeah, at this stage, yeah. Yeah, we're pretty confident. I mean, in the Irish accents, we haven't done explicit studies, but in the US, we're actually working with the Florida Center for Reading Research. And they've, you know, there was a huge issue, and it was mentioned in an article in the New York Times where they found that speech recognition was very biased towards certain demographics over black voices versus white voices. And it was actually quite a big deal, right, because the systems are biased because of the data they were built on. But that group in Florida Center for Reading Research did a study on our technology across a number of different districts, you know, privileged districts, lower income socioeconomic variances across the US, and they found no difference, no bias. And that was particularly strong for us and particularly something that we're very proud of.
Where did you come up with this idea?
So about 2013, I was observing my daughter, you know, I was giving her an iPad, right? And I was doing that thing that parents do that when you're trying to leave your guilt, you're just at least trying to make sure it's educational, right? So I'd done my research, I'd found this amazing platform that teaches kids this emergent stage of reading. She was only like 3.5, but I was being, you know, okay, we'll give her this and see how it works. And then, but then the research in me was kind of saying, well, let's just see how she gets on if I don't interfere. And she was progressing. It was a really cool game, and it was, little monsters were going on these journeys, and it was trying to teach the kids the sounds of learning to read, like cat is cat. And she was doing great. I was getting email updates that she was passing all these levels, and, you know, she'd achieved all these different goals, and she knew all these sounds. So I was like, wow, okay, that's pretty impressive for my 3-year-old. But when I actually quizzed her on it, she was just like shrugging, going, I don't know. I was like, okay, there's something going on. So I started to watch how she was playing it, and I observed that what they were doing was they'd play her a sound, like the K sound, C sound, and then they'd give her two paths, so the little monster could go one, left or right, or, you know, up or down. And she'd just hit one of them. And if it got it wrong, it sent her back around again. She'd just go, OK, that one didn't work. I guess I'll just do the other one. So it was multi-choice. And she was hacking it at 3.5. She was, you know, remarkably smart in a different way. Hadn't learned to read, but, like, you know, I'd figured out how to hack the game, which was impressive on its own.
You'd underestimated her, Patricia, had you?
I did. And as an engineer, I was going, OK, that's something that will stand to you in life, that alone. We'll get you to read later, but that's good. But what I observed by seeing that was that, you know what, I'd spent my whole career in speech recognition technology and was like, well, that's a huge missing piece here. And why has nobody addressed this? Because it was 2013, right? Siri was out, Siri was on our phones, Apple had acquired Siri. You know, it was pre-Alexa, pre-OK Google, but it was around that time. So I just was trying to figure out, well, why has nobody built this or put it into these platforms that are teaching kids to read or teach them English language learning or any of these? And then the more I did the research, it was like, OK, it's a really hard problem. Kids are different to adults and nobody is addressing this.
And to some extent, Patricia, teaching your daughter how to read at 3, you're making other parents feel a bit inadequate here, are you?
Well, no, I was alleviating my guilt. Let's go with that one instead, right? By giving her an emergent reader thing. She was happy, I was happy, you know, that way.
And it wasn't Japanese?
No. We leave that for later. Yeah, that'll be next. She's 10 now. You know, I mean, this is, you know,
she's on the Japanese now, is she?
Yeah, now she's doing it. We'll get her doing Irish first. She'll be grand. Yeah.
You mentioned that you did a PhD in speech recognition. When you did that, did you have a clear idea of where you wanted to go with it?
No, not in the slightest. It was back in 2000, so I was 26 at the time. So I'd done engineering in college. You know, I enjoyed it to an extent, but when I started working and I kind of had this idea, oh no, I wanted to invent things. You know, a job in engineering wasn't inventing. It was, you know, it was interesting, but it wasn't invent. So I kind of wanted to go back and do research and just probably just kick around college for another couple of years, really, if I was perfectly honest about it. But, you know, it was a very interesting area. It was a very nascent area, right? It was 2000. It was a very different thing, but I liked the idea of, you know, doing research on technology that interacts with humans, you know, that end-user interaction as opposed to more of an abstract engineering challenge. Actually, it was funny because back in 2003, I was in IBM research. I spent a good bit of time in New York during my PhD in Columbia University and then in IBM research. And we were introduced to the concept of a voice assistant in 2003. We were sitting through a demo in IBM. It was so impressive. The guy was like, you know, I'm sitting in a car now. He's in, obviously, a conference room, but I'm sitting in a car and I'm going to talk. And he had this computer. Computer was the assistant. And, it was easier to understand if he said the name twice. And then he was getting directions to an Italian restaurant. And the assistant was telling him that the traffic was bad and was going to reroute him and to the best restaurant in the area. And we were like, this is amazing. This is like two, three years away. This is the, but you know, 2003, we're going, this is 2-3 years away, max. Yeah. And it's like 2020 and we barely have this working. Like, it just shows, you know, like demos are very misleading. You know, getting to work in the real world is the biggest challenge.
How far do you think the technology in this area can go 10, 15 years from now? Where do you think it might be?
I think it will be hugely impressive. And I think we'll feel it. You know, I think we felt a very big jump in the last 5 years. It might slow down a little bit, but it will just gradually get better and better. And you'll barely notice it, but you'll be getting so much more natural interactions. We'll eventually be, you know, incorporating gestures and facial expressions and nodding and shaking and pointing and all these things. We'll get more and more towards how humans interact with each other, which, you know, they say that, you know, human communication is only 7% verbal. A lot of it is incorporating so much more into our conversations and how we understand each other. And that's where computers need to go.
So at some point we'll be able to ask our fridge whether there's any milk left in it. But the question is, do we really want to? Would it not be better to just open the door and have a look?
You will. It'll be there and you'll just use it because it's so much more convenient. You can do it while you're sitting down.
We're going to become, you know, that lazy, are we, Patricia?
I know. Yeah. Exactly.
It's inevitable. Imagine. Now, in an age of concerns about data, what about the concerns of who has access to our children's voices?
Yeah, that's really, really critical and it's huge, right? So whatever we feel about ourselves, we're more protective and children's data is more sensitive. So, I mean, as such, so when we started this in 2013, COPPA, it's like the GDPR equivalent in the US, preceded GDPR, but it's specifically for kids under 13. In 2012, they explicitly said that audio and video was personally identifiable information, so you need to seek permission from the parent in order to be able to do it. Now, back in 2013, it was like the Wild West of data. Nobody really understood that, you know, all these social media and all these, they were basically data gathering exercises, a lot of them, like, you know. But we decided, knowing how important data was, because I'd worked my whole career in speech, you know, speech recognition, machine learning, knowing that data is the crux of it. You can't build garbage in, garbage out. If you don't have good data, you're not going to build good AI. But being a parent, and quite a few of us in the company were parents, understood that, well, no, I'll be particularly sensitive about my kids' data. So from the get-go, it wasn't cheaper and it wasn't quicker to do this in a privacy-first way, right? To take what we were building and making sure we were fully compliant, making sure we were auditable, and making sure we were able to trace back every piece of data and delete as required, and be compliant with, you know, privacy laws across the globe. We will never sell our data. We'll never license our data for marketing, product placement. We don't have any competing business models.
I suppose, though, if one day somebody came along with a large checkbook and they bought the business from you, they might have a different view.
Yeah, we've made agreements. No, actually, they couldn't. See, that's the nice thing about it is, like, you know, the agreement you make with a parent or a child, it's like, you know, what you agreed that can be done with that data. That can't be undone.
Now, you grew up in Nace, and was there, you mentioned about studying engineering, you wanted to invent things. Were the family technically minded or interested in that area?
Yeah, that's quite a history of tech minds in our family. My granddad would have, you know, he wouldn't have gone to college or secondary, but I remember stories of him building an electricity generator in his hometown before the ESB ever came to came there, you know.
He built his own generator.
And that's just the inventor in him, like, you know. And you know, my dad similarly was, you know, very technically maths minded. Always kind of pulling things apart, very, you know, curious, tinkering kind of thing, as I did as well.
So you wanted to outdo the granddad?
Yeah. I don't think I've ever built a generator. You need ambition to build generators or build physical things.
Well, at some point you decided to use all of that, those inventive instincts and your background and the speech recognition PhD and all of that, to build a business. And that's a big step that lots of people don't have the appetite to do.
Yeah. That is, growing up in our house, well, my mother she was a stay-at-home mom and ended up running as an independent councillor for Nace Urban District Council. And, you know, without any, you know, not going with the parties, going independent, taking them all on was actually quite a brave step, putting yourself out there. Like, so, you know, seeing that growing up, definitely say, you know, take a chance, you know. I mean, what's the worst that could happen? You fail, right? You know, it'll affect your ego. But, you know, yeah, it was enjoyable to take on.
And it's interesting that you have a business that is backed by outside funders, but it's a female-led high-growth company. And the fact is, there aren't that many of those. And very often, female-led companies find it difficult to actually get the backing from outside investors.
Yeah, that's very true. Tragically true, as do, you know, ethnic minorities, women, you know, the numbers are just chronically bad across the world. And they haven't improved in years.
What is that about? Why do you think that is?
I think when it comes to the decision making about who to invest in, who to put your money behind, people will feel comfortable with certain areas, for certain topics, for certain products, certain people, right? You know, they remind them of themselves. If you're decision makers at the investment committee, so whether you're an angel investor or you're a VC or you're private equity, whatever you are, when you're making decisions, if everybody around the table is male or if there's no people of colour, how do you expect the decision making to change in the long term? Because you will have biases. You won't understand somebody's pitch. You won't understand the product. You won't understand the demographic they're trying to address. if you have a homogenous decision-making group.
Can the government do anything about it, do you think?
Yes, certainly. Enterprise Ireland are an LP in every single one of our VCs in Ireland. You know, they are a decision-maker. If Enterprise Ireland decided to make it mandatory to have a certain number of investments with female-led, you know, or female founders included, mixed founders, you know, not just all male, not just all female, that would change. Absolutely, and I'd encourage that. I struggle to see why we haven't done it yet. It's been shown time and time again that balance in companies or boards or anything like that, it has led to more profitable companies.
And what about the business and the future? You're employing around 28 people at the moment. Where do you see the growth? How big would you like to take that? Would you consider floating it on the stock market at some point, or what are your plans?
Yeah, I mean, all that's possible. We are now... We're in a space where voice technology is exploding, right? We're at the nexus of voice technology, kid tech, ed tech. Even pre-COVID, it was a momentous time, right? So for us, this was like this wave was coming. It's like a tipping point where speech recognition has gone mainstream. It's, you know, in your toys, kids are almost disappointed now when their toy can't hear them and talk back. My son practically got upset with a toy he'd bought, and his granddad had bought him, because sitting in the back of the car with a face on him saying, you know, it can't hear me, you know. It just dawned on me, God, yeah, of course, you're listening. You know, you would expect that as a kid these days.
It's a long way from G.I. Joe with the kung fu grip.
Yeah, and they're, yeah, exactly. They're like, why can't, if Alexa can hear me, why can't this hear me? But also, you know, we're in the middle of an unprecedented crisis that doesn't seem to be abating. And what's happened is we've seen an acceleration in demand for voice-enabled reading and assessments and fluency assessments, because we're all struggling right now with kids in the home trying to learn. Voice technology can act as a helpful adult, right? Gives the computer ears to listen, prompt, encourage a child and allow them to progress the reading at home without the need for a parent to also do that when you've more than one kid, you have your own job to be doing, you know.
Or that you could just watch something good on Netflix while educating themselves.
Exactly. But what there is a huge demand right now, given this crisis that's not going away, is that for tools, educational tools that allow a kid to progress themselves at home. Researchers have done study, and since lockdown started in March in the US, to very recently, kids have fallen behind 7 months. So there's always this thing called a summer fade when kids go off for summer holidays. You know, by the time they get back in September, they've lost ground a little bit. But this is something different. This is something we've never had before, where kids are going to lose a hell of a lot of ground, and disadvantaged students are suffering, you know, even more. And that's something that we need to address. And what we're seeing is ed tech companies in the US are accelerating their efforts to get these types of products to market.
So we're all trying to make up for lost time. Patricia Scanlon of Soapbox Labs, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you.